2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13. Right? 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 13. So, we meet our quota.
We meet the quota.
Everybody likes the company, Friday.
Just late, I'll leave.
By the way, I was here last Friday after you gave the quiz.
Matt?
What? Nothing, never mind.
I was sick last Friday instead of.
Well, don't worry, it's only. Okay.
And the point's big.
So Cal said you were all experts on Laplace transforms. He said you didn't even have to lecture, you knew everything.
Yeah, I got my PhD.
And you believe.
So, what is Laplace transform?
It's a version of the Fourier transform.
It's a generalization of the Fourier transform. What does it allow us to do?
Look at cases the Fourier transform is kind of.
Okay, it gives us both the transient and steady state response of the system in one transform, right? And the Fourier transform is actually, it can in most cases be derived from the Laplace transform. And there's one minor complication with the two sides of the Laplace transform, which is the region of convergence. And we talked a little bit about that last time. So here I'm showing a slide we went through last time, the Laplace transform of the signal e to the minus at u of t. That's a one sided, it's a right sided signal. It's zero for all time less than zero. And you went through the calculation of the Laplace transform for this, the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of e to the minus at u of t e to the minus st dt. And you simplified this, but you showed that it only converges when you're in this region s greater than minus a. So we introduced a concept called region of convergence, and that's the region in the s-plane for which this integral will actually converge. And that's because we have this e to the minus st term, we have to worry a little bit about whether that integral, the integral of that converges. So I'm going to sort of build on that concept today when we talk about properties. So if you have questions, now's a good time to ask them. But you don't, because Cal is a good teacher, so.
What is the meaning of life?
What is the meaning of life? 3.1415. What? Don't you? I heard something you all know.
Wait, let me get my calculator. I think it knows.
So, I'm going to talk about properties of the Laplace transform today, but by virtue of this being a linear transform, what do we know about most of the properties that we've seen for the Fourier transform and the Fourier series?
They're just a big table.
What do we know about those properties with respect to Laplace transform?
Oh, they're normal properties for like algebraic operations, pretty much, right?
Right. So we would expect that most of the properties that we've seen with the Fourier transform should hold for the Laplace transform. What were some of the useful properties that we saw for the Fourier transform?
Linearity. Commutativity.
Okay. Modulation, we used it pretty extensively.
Multiplication,
convolution.
Right.
So we'll go through a few of these today and talk about them. The only minor complication is going to be we'll have to pay some attention to the region of convergence. So to introduce the inverse Laplace transform, and then we'll end up the day with a really nice result for Friday morning, which is complex integration, which I know you all just love to do. So, to introduce the inverse Laplace transform and some important applications of the transform, such as circuits, we will need to introduce some familiar properties of the transform. We'll need things like linearity. There are some properties unique to the Laplace transform, things like the initial value theorem. There are some properties that do not have an equivalent for the Laplace transform, things like duality, Parseval's theorem. But most of our use familiar properties like linearity do hold. So what is linearity? Well, if I have a signal which is the weighted sum of two signals, A times x1 of t plus A times x2 of t, and I want to calculate the Laplace transform of this signal, I would hope that it turns out to be A times the Laplace transform of x1 plus B times the Laplace transform of x2. Now, why is this property so useful to us? Now that you've seen a fair amount of analysis in this class, why is this property useful to us?
Superposition?
In what sense?
You can calculate one ignoring the other, and then calculate the other ignoring the one that you previously calculated and add them up.
No, that's essentially what this property is. But why is this property useful? Where do we make use of this property extensively? In relation to this course.
Summing signals?
A direct application is summing signals. But in terms of our signal, ways we've talked about representing signals and things, where is this used? Give me an example.
I was here to look at the even and odd components of the signal.
Okay, so, and where do we do that, something like that, initially?
With just looking at the Fourier transform in different ways. Fourier series.
Fourier series. What are we doing with a Fourier series? What is the essence of a Fourier series?
It's a summation.
We represent some complex periodic signal as a sum of sines and cosines, right? Why is this property useful in the context of that kind of a representation?
That property allows you to do summations.
So if I want to take the Fourier, the Laplace transform of the signal that's represented by a Fourier series, how would I compute the Laplace transform? So one of the fundamental concepts in this class is the ability to take a signal and represent it as a weighted sum of other signals. And that's what a Fourier series is. We represent a signal, like we can approximate, for example, a voice signal as a weighted sum of sines and cosines. Right? That's a Fourier series, if the voice signal is periodic. Then we can do things like take the Laplace transform. All we really need to worry about is what the Laplace transform of a sine and a cosine is, which we can easily look up in a table or easily derive. And then I can actually compute the Laplace transform of the Fourier series, because all I have to do now is take a weighted sum of the transforms of sines and cosines. Now, where do we make use of that? Well, when you watch something like a progressively scanned JPEG and you see the image refreshing itself with more and more detail, that's essentially the combination of a representation somewhat like a Fourier series, but also the ability to look at that signal in the frequency domain using something like Laplace transform. Those refreshes, the information that's represented in those refreshes are essentially higher order coefficients associated with these kinds of descriptions of signals. So these decompositions into something like a Fourier series, they allow us to sort of organize information in the signal so that the most important stuff is first, the least important stuff is later, the high frequency stuff typically. And then you can do things like compress and transmit that signal And you can decide how much of that information you want to transmit. Well, in a progressively scanned JPEG, you transmit the low-frequency information first, so you get a rough view of the image, and then it refreshes, and you get a more and more detailed view of the image. So the reason we need properties like this is so that we can combine the, we can operate on these representations of signals like Fourier series and such. And there's many, many different ways we represent signals. You may have heard the term wavelets, for example. Wavelets are used extensively in a lot of applications as a way of decomposing a signal into its components. And then you transmit those components, or some subset of those components, depending on how many bits you want to spend. Now, in the context of Laplace transform, we have a little bit of a problem here because we have to worry about the region of convergence. Well, the region of convergence for the sum of these two signals is at least the intersection of the region of convergence for the components. So we need to, if we're going to add these two signals together, the region of convergence is going to be defined as the intersection of these two. In some special cases, the region of convergence can be larger, such as when the signals cancel each other out. And a simple example of that is if A is equal to minus B and X1 is equal to X2, the sum of these two signals is zero, and the region of convergence is the entire S-plane, and it doesn't really matter what the region of convergence of these two were, but these could have a different region of convergence. So let's apply this property of linearity to be able to compute a Laplace transform by simply looking at the constituents and applying the Laplace transform of those constituents. And that is something that we will use in circuits. In circuits, when you have a signal, which is perhaps a combination of things, a DC term, a sine wave, a pulse, and other things, you can break the you can compute the outputs by simply operating on each one of those independently. So here we have x of t is equal to u of t plus e to the minus t u of t. And we can compute the Laplace transform of this using linearity by asking what is the Laplace transform of u of t and what is the Laplace transform of e to the minus t u of t. And we have actually derived those previously. Laplace transform of u of t is what? Okay, last time you derived this, 1 over s. Laplace transform of e to the minus t u of t, you've derived an e to the minus a t u of t. And so here we have a is equal to 1, so Laplace transform of this e to the minus t u of t is just 1 over s plus 1. You may remember this being written as 1 over s plus a, where a, we had e to the minus a t here. So then you can actually, if you like, combine these two, and you can write this as a ratio of polynomials. Very often we write Laplace transforms as ratios of polynomials because that's a very convenient way to represent a transfer function. We'll talk later about Bode plots. In the Z domain, we'll talk about difference equations and things. So we sort of like things in terms of polynomials. And we also like to have the denominator factored because then it's clear what the poles and zeros of the signal are. We'll talk about that a little bit later as well. So this is an application of our familiar property of linearity. Well, let's look at time shift. The time shift property says that if I time delay x of t by a period by an amount capital T, the corresponding Laplace transform is e to the minus st times x of s. So I just have to take the transform for x of s, for x of t, take the transform for x of t and multiply it by e to the minus st. What was the analog of this with the Fourier transform? Just phase shift. We had e to the minus j theta term. So we can go ahead and apply this. If I have something like e to the minus 2t u of t, we can write that x of s is just 1 over s plus 2, just applying our property our transform pair for e to the minus a t u of t. And the region of convergence here is when s is greater than minus 2, because this is a right-sided signal. So if I then ask you to take the Laplace transform of e to the minus 2 times t minus 3 times u of t minus 3, well, we can compute the Laplace transform by treating this as this signal delayed by 3. So we can take this transform and multiply it by e to the minus s 3, or e to the minus 3s, and we have then that the transform is e to the minus 3s over s plus 2, and the region of convergence stays the same, so it's everywhere, it's for s greater than minus 2. So the region of convergence doesn't change in this case because it's actually defined by the pole location, not the numerator part. Okay, so next I can do something a little more interesting. I can build up the Laplace transform of a pulse. If I plot this function, what does this look like? We've seen that now a few times, right? U of t, what does u of t look like?
It goes up at 0.
That's u of t, right? And what is u of t minus capital T?
It's
shifted. So if I difference these two, what am I left with?
A pulse.
I'm left with something like this. Now, I could take the Laplace transform of this by simply taking the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of u of t minus u of t minus t times e to the minus st dt and so forth. But it's much easier to simply combine our properties of linearity and time shift. So I have for u of t, I have 1 over s. For u of t minus capital T, I have e to the minus capital T times s, using this property, times 1 over s. So if I then combine these two, I have 1 minus e to the minus capital T times s over s. Now, what is the... Does anybody want to take a guess at what the ROC curve is for this signal? Because...
You only have s.
But you also have an s here. It's a time limited signal. This integral.
Than 0 and less than t.
Can be written from 0 to t, right? This signal is only non zero. This signal is only non-zero from 0 to t.
So is it the region of convergence?
Can this integral go off to infinity?
Yeah. It could go to... Wait, what?
So this is going to be 1 minus e to the minus st over s, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it would converge to 0. Or the limit would be 0. No way.
So if s goes to 0, what happens to this?
No, I mean, as it approaches infinity, it would be 0.
As it goes to 0, it would be only 5.
What is this approach?
Infinity.
Infinity?
8, 1, 0.
When s goes to 0 here, what do we get here?
zero and the exponent, so it would be one minus one is zero.
Oh, the zero right here.
You get one minus one over
close to zero. It's undefined, but I guess you would say it approaches zero.
How would you actually determine the limit of this as s goes to zero?
You'd have to take the derivative of the top over the derivative of the bottom.
What do we call that?
L'Hopital's rule.
L'Hopital's rule. So I'm going to leave this as something to ponder over the weekend, since you're all, I see a little bit of confusion. I'd like to know on Monday, what is the region of convergence for that? And you can find it in the textbook, so. But somebody better find it, or I'll give you a quiz on Monday. So if someone wants to email the answer to the class, then you're off.
What type of quiz?
As long as you read your email.
This would be a real quiz. Now, what about time scaling? Let's take, let's look at what happens with, if I have x of a times t, the corresponding Laplace transform is 1 over a times x of s over a. So an example of the application of this property is if I take u of t and I time scale it, I have u of a times t. And I apply this property, well, I'll just take the transform of u of t, which is 1 over s, and then I'll multiply by 1 over a, and then I'll substitute s with s over a. So I have 1 over a times 1 over s over a. And lo and behold, the a's cancel, and I'm still left with the Laplace transform being 1 over s for u of a times t. Now, does that make sense?
Somewhere along the way it does, but...
So how, if you had to draw u of a times t for a equals 5, what would it look like? We have u of t for a is equal to 1 here.
It would be a magnitude of 5 larger, right?
No, that would be a u of t.
No.
Like, u of a t, does that just mean that it lasts 5 seconds longer? Or
it would be compressed, right?
This thing goes on for infinity, right? U of t?
Mm-hmm.
I would just u of t.
So if I have u of t...
So u of a t is just u of t.
Right. There's no real difference in the signal. So that's why we get the same transform.
So in a circuit, like, just to make it something that isn't purely mathematical, like, what do the zeros and poles represent?
Okay, we'll spend more time on that later in the semester, but they're essentially the poles are the resonances of the system.
Okay.
The zeros are areas where the frequency response goes down to zero. So if you look at a good example might be the way analog television used to work. You had to use zeros if you wanted to separate out the particular channel that you're looking at and some components of the signal. And whereas the poles represent areas where the spectrum is large. So poles, we've talked about, poles relate to resonances. We talked about the Tacoma-Narrows bridge earlier in the class, and if you analyze that structure using Laplace transform, you can actually predict the resonant frequencies. And that relates to the poles. So I was on the way home from the airport, I was on a bridge near Birmingham, and a few trucks roll by, and the bridge starts bouncing. And the frequency it's bouncing at is related to what?
The response of the bridge.
Well, what physical aspects of the bridge do you think relate to how the frequency at which the bridge is bouncing?
The length.
The length of the bridge, right? The span between two columns. Yeah. So as these trucks are coming through, they're kind of applying impulses, and that's causing the bridge to vibrate. And if the bridge is not designed right, it'll start as if the truck, and this has actually happened, if trucks are spaced at a certain distance and they drive over a bridge, you can actually get a pretty significant vibration in the bridge. Because they're hitting, every time a truck hits it, it's reinforcing you know, it's exactly at the right phase where it's reinforcing the vibration.
So canceling it out, it's amplifying.
Right. So sometimes
constructive interference.
They have to do this kind of a statistical analysis when they're building bridges. They're going to carry lots of vehicles and try to make sure that under some crazy combination of vehicles, the bridge doesn't start oscillating really in a wild direction. Yeah, you have to. Structural engineers have to worry about these kinds of things.
Parking garages do that a lot too. You can fill it with your parking garage.
Yeah.
Wasn't there a bridge that collapsed?
Yeah, I think there was some cases like that where it was a unique set of circumstances that caused the oscillations to be much larger than they should have been.
Shook itself apart.
They've also had trouble with cantilever type structures in like hotel atriums. They've had some of those collapse over the years, and various things like that. So it's all can be related to this kind of analysis. And in fact, it is this kind of thing is used for mechanical structures. So you can always get a job as a civil engineer if you get tired of electrical engineering.
Apparently not.
So multiplication by power of t. If we take a signal and multiply it by a power of t to the n x of t, the corresponding Laplace transform is minus 1 to the n times the nth derivative of x of s. So multiplication by t in the time domain is differentiation by s in the Laplace domain. And in this case, the same region of convergence for the result as for the original signal x of s. And we can compare this to the Fourier transform. You can see now to some extent where the Fourier transform property comes from. This is what we have for the Fourier transform. We multiply by j to the n, which alternates between 1 and minus 1. So as an application of this property, we can derive the transform for r of t by noting that this is just t times u of t, and therefore the Laplace transform of r of t, well, we can just take the first derivative of the Laplace transform for u of t. The Laplace transform for u of t is 1 over s. So we have minus 1 to the 1 power times the first derivative of 1 over s. And that's if you work through that, the derivative of 1 over s is minus 1 over s squared. The minus 1's cancel, and we're just left with 1 over s squared. Then we can flip this around and talk about if a differentiation in the time domain and multiplication by s in the frequency domain. So the nth derivative of x of t is equal to the Laplace transform of that is equal to simply take x of s and multiply by s to the nth power. But in this case, the ROC the result can actually be bigger than the ROC for x of t because we have this s term here. So as an example of this, we can derive the Laplace transform of the impulse function delta of t by noting that that's the derivative of u of t. So we can multiply the transform of u of t, which is 1 over s, times s, since we just have the first derivative, and we have then that the Laplace transform of delta of t is equal to 1. And you'll notice that the region of convergence for delta of t, which is everywhere, is a larger region than the region of convergence for u of t, which was the right, everything to the right of the j omega of the imaginary axis. Now, why is this property useful to us? You've actually used this property when you've analyzed circuits with Laplace transformed, if you've had a chance to do that. Where do we see this property being used? You've used it in circuits. In what way?
In speed up the way that you analyze RLC circuits, right?
Right, using impedances, right? You write J omega L or 1 over J omega C, by the time you got to this course, you would also do Laplace transforms. I don't think you do that anymore, is that right?
Well, we see them a little bit in DE.
Yeah. So, and this is also, and then again, this is useful in DE. This is used directly in differential equations, and circuits and differential equations are really the same thing, so.
Well,
yeah. right? I mean, the circuit's just a differential equation. The differential equations are one of the mathematical techniques we use to describe most any system. So everything's ultimately a differential equation. That's why we pound that into you in so many courses. But you'll come to appreciate that as you get out into the real world and you start working on real systems which are modeled with differential equations. It's just with circuits, we teach you all these kind of special little tricks, but they're all really just variants of how you deal with differential equations. We can also talk about integration, the analog of, or the opposite of differentiation. So if we integrate a signal from 0 to t, that's equivalent to multiplying by 1 over s times x of s, and therefore the ROC region cannot include s equals 0, because we have this 0, when s becomes 0, that comes into that. So integrating a signal is equivalent to multiplying by 1 over s in the Laplace domain. And this, again, this is what we want, because this reduces things like differentiation and integration to simple algebraic operations. We can also do convolution. So you will recall, in our definition of convolution, we have an input signal, we have a linear time invariant system whose impulse response is h of t, and we can write that the output is x of t convolved with h of t. Mathematically, what that means is we're going to take the integral from minus infinity to t of x of lambda, h of t minus lambda, d lambda. The Laplace transform is analogous to the Fourier transform, which means we can compute y of s as simply x of s times h of s. And then we can get back to y of t by computing the inverse Laplace transform of y of s. But because the Laplace transform and its inverse are not, its inverse basically is not quite so simple, and we'll talk about that in a moment, the dual of this is not true. That to get back to, if we take x of t and multiply it by h of t, that is not actually x of s convolved with h of s. This property does not, this did hold for the Fourier transform. Remember we said convolution in the time domain was multiplication in the frequency domain. Multiplication in the time domain was convolution in the frequency domain. This is not true for the Laplace transform, and it's one reason the Fourier transform is more popular for applications involving communication systems and modulation. Further, when we want to do this, and we want to go back from y of s to y of t, the inverse Laplace transform is a little more difficult to compute. So we'll have to develop some special techniques to do that, and I'll show you why at the end of this lecture when we talk about contour integration in the complex plane, which I know you all live for. It's actually pretty cool, but you don't get exposed to it much anymore. So the region of convergence is at least for this convolution operation, is at least the overlap of region of convergence for each signal. And it can be larger than the ROC for either signal if there's some pole zero cancellation. So here we have our pulse. X of t is equal to u of t minus 1. And we can note that x of s is 1 minus e to the minus s over s. We can derive that on the previous slide. So the convolution of x of t with itself, which we'll call y of t, this is just taking x of s and multiplying it by itself, or x of s squared, and that's just this 1 minus e to the minus s over s squared, and we can write that in polynomial form as 1 minus 2 e to the minus s plus e to the minus 2s divided by s squared. And we can actually take that should be y of t. The inverse Laplace transform of this, and the inverse Laplace transform of this is going to be the inverse Laplace transform of 1 over s squared minus 2 times the inverse Laplace transform of e to the minus s over s squared plus the inverse Laplace transform of e to the minus 2s over s squared. But don't panic just yet, because we can look at this using our property from the previous page. We have this property with time delay. We can exploit that and make this actually pretty simple. This 1 over s squared, the inverse Laplace transform of this is just t times u of t. We can use our property of multiplication by 1 over s for that. And this e to the minus s over s squared, this is just going to be a time delay version of this. We can just write that as, since we have this e to the minus s here, we each have a time delay of 1, so we can write this as minus 2 times t minus 1 times u of t minus 1. And then we can do the same thing here. We can write this as simply this thing delayed by 2. So we have t minus 2 times u of t minus 2. So we were able to get the inverse Laplace transform of this fairly easily by combining our linearity and time delay properties. Absolutely. Now, with the Laplace transform, we're going to spend a lot of time on what are called one-sided signals. So we're going to define a special case of the Laplace transform where we integrate from 0 to infinity and deal only with signals which are 0 for t less than 0. This is called the unilateral or one-sided Laplace transform. And it's useful particularly when we're dealing with causal systems. And in fact, in this textbook, they focus mostly on the one-sided Laplace transform. And they kind of skip over the two-sided. But the two-sided is useful when we talk about Z-transforms. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the two-sided. So several of our properties change slightly, such as differentiation. The derivative of a one-sided signal becomes s times x of s, but we have this initial condition, minus the value of x at 0, and we write 0 minus, meaning the value of x as you approach from the minus real axis, the negative real axis. And we have, for the second derivative, a similar form. We have s squared times x of s, but we also have x times s times x of 0 minus from here, and then we have an additional term, which is the derivative of x when we approach from 0 minus. And we can actually prove this by looking at the one-sided Laplace transform of dx dt, and we can integrate that using integration by parts and derive this. I'll skip the details. It's all there for you. It's straightforward. Other properties such as convolution hold as long as the system is causal. So you're going to notice that in this chapter, with the one-sided Laplace transform, we spend a lot of time looking at causal signals and signals that begin, input signals that begin when t is equal to 0. A couple properties that are somewhat unique to the Laplace transform are the initial value and final value theorems. Remember, we said that the Laplace transform lets you calculate the transient response of a system as well as the steady state response. So we can, in fact, use the Laplace transform to get the value of the signal at 0 and the value of the signal at infinity. And we call this the initial value theorem and the final value theorem. The initial value theorem says that the value of x at 0 is equal to the value of the Laplace transform multiplied by s, and then you take the limit as s goes to infinity. The final value theorem says the value of x at infinity is equal to the limit as s goes to 0 of s times x of s. Now these are interesting because it shows you that the sort of duality, the fact that the value of x at 0 is related to what happens to the Laplace transform at infinity, and the value of x at infinity is related to what happens to the Laplace transform at 0. So this is sort of another example of the duality property. We can apply these things. So for example, if we want the, we have this, we can actually prove this property. I think what I'm going to do, since we're running a little slow, is I'll just skip this, but you can derive these properties using a combination of our time domain differentiation, the steps in the proof are shown there. And the initial value theorem can actually be extended to higher order derivatives, so that you can talk about what happens to the first derivative of x of t at t is equal to zero, and you can relate that to the Laplace transform. We won't use that as often as we'll use the theorem in the form stated at the top of the page. But this allows the initial and final values to be computed directly from the transform. So one application of that is the steady state response, or trying to determine whether a system is stable, whether as time goes to infinity, the system will go to zero, the impulse response. And you can do that without actually computing the impulse response. You can just look at the transfer function and apply the final value theorem. So let's look at an application of this. Consider a Laplace transform that's the ratio of two polynomials of S, which we'll write as N of S and D of S, where N is the order of N of S and D is the order of D of S. We can apply the initial value theorem, and we can write that the initial value of this, whatever signal corresponds to the inverse transform of this, can be found from the limit as S goes to infinity of S times this. Well, if we multiply S times this, we're going to essentially have S to the N plus 1 in the numerator, because that's the highest power of S. We'll have S to the D in the denominator. And we see that this is going to be finite, this limit. If D is greater than N plus 1, it'll go to 0. If D is equal to N plus 1, it'll be some value, not 0, but some finite value. And if D is less than N plus 1, it'll go to infinity. So that tells you a little bit about the behavior of a system when you have a ratio of two polynomials. Now later we'll see, when you do circuits, it's very common to get a transfer function which is a ratio of two polynomials. So we can use this to tell something about the stability and the initial values of circuits. So as an example, we can take the Laplace transform of 1 over s plus 1, and we can determine that the value of x of t, whatever that is, can be found by taking the limit as s goes to infinity of this thing multiplied by s, and that gives us s over s, because the s plus 1 converges to s when s becomes large, and that's just equal to 1. And then similarly, we can look at 1 over s plus 1 squared, and we can determine that the initial value of that is just s over s squared, and that goes to 0. So x of 0, the inverse Laplace transform of this, has an initial value of 0. And then we can do the same kind of thing with the final value theorem. We can look at the final value of this 1 over s plus 1, and that's just taking the limit as s goes to 0 of s times x of s, which is just s over s plus 1, and that goes to 1 as s goes to 0. And similarly, 1 over s plus 1 squared has a final value of 0. So that's just an example of how we can apply the initial value and the final value theorem to a couple transforms that we've seen before. Now, the inverse Laplace transform is a little bit more difficult to compute. If you recall our expression for the Laplace transform, we know that S is equal to sigma plus j omega, and this is just essentially the Fourier transform of x of t times e to the minus at. That's one way to think about the relationship between the Laplace transform and the Fourier transform. We can apply the inverse Fourier transform to this, and we can write that we can essentially take the inverse Fourier transform of this, which, if you remember, is the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of x of j omega e to the j omega t d omega. And that will give us x of t. That'll actually give us x of t times e to the minus a t, since we started with this. We can multiply both sides by e to the minus a t, so we can write an expression for x of t as 1 over 2 pi times the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of x of sigma plus j omega times e to the quantity sigma plus j omega t d omega. And for a fixed sigma, we can write that s is equal to sigma plus j omega. The derivative of s, if sigma is fixed, is j d omega. And therefore, we can write then that x of t is 1 over 2 pi j, just moving a j here, times the integral from sigma minus j infinity to sigma plus j infinity of x of s e to the st ds. And we know we write this as 1 over 2 pi j. We call this a contour integral times x of s e to the st ds. So mathematically, this is the definition of the inverse Laplace transform. Now, how you actually do that integral is beyond the scope of this course, so we won't do inverse Laplace transforms this way. But if you go on to take a course in complex variables, you'll learn all about how to do what are essentially line integrals in a complex space. We call them contour integrals. And there's a nice relation. You can actually evaluate these integrals in terms of what are called residues, which is actually where your partial fractions expansion comes from and all that. If you remember how you do partial fractions expansion, it actually comes from this theory. So there are different ways to evaluate this integral in terms of essentially the poles of the signal. But we're going to restrict ourselves to two types of Laplace transforms. We're going to deal with ratios of polynomials, and we're going to deal with exponentials, because this is essentially what you get when you deal with differential equations, linear constant coefficient differential equations, and this is essentially what you get when you deal with time delay. And those are sort of the two building blocks for signal processing. So we'll be able to do the inverse Laplace transforms of signals of this form without actually doing contour integration, since contour integration is kind of difficult. So the unilateral Laplace transform can be applied to finding both the transient and steady state responses of a circuit, as well as the frequency response. And this is why the Laplace transform is so important to circuit analysis. You can essentially get everything in one transform. And however, to do that, particularly when you're dealing with ratios and polynomials, we're going to need to be able to factor a polynomial into its roots. And you've learned how to do this in calculus. MATLAB has good support for this, but you also know that that's not a trivial process when you have a very high order polynomial. So we'll show you some techniques how to deal with that. I think the next lecture we're going to talk about inverse Laplace transforms. So, what we've done today essentially is to introduce another table of properties for the Laplace transform, and that's essentially what I'm showing here. We talked specifically about linearity, about time delay, time scaling, and a few of these others. And we had an analogous set of properties for the Fourier series, for the Fourier transform, and we'll have a similar properties for the Z transform. So here they're just enumerated in a table for you for the Laplace transform. And as you begin to work homework problems where you have to take the Laplace transform of complicated signals, the goal will be to break them down into some components using these properties. So that's so now we've introduced Laplace transform, we've showed you how to compute Laplace transforms using direct integration and using these properties. And I think the next lecture we'll be talking about how to do inverse Laplace transforms. And then we'll also begin applying this to circuits. Okay, I will see you on Monday.
So the limit of